Rock.com. Hello and welcome to Aryan Narrations. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks. And today's narration will be part 5 from The Traditions of Glastonbury by E. Raymond Capt. And we're going to begin by looking at the 12th century abbey of Glastonbury. King Henry II did not allow the abbey to remain in ruins. He immediately issued a royal charter to rebuild, declaring that because whatsoever a man soweth, that shall he also reap. This meant that since the church was reduced to ashes while in his hands, he or his heirs, God willing, should magnificently complete the rebuilding of the church of Glastonbury. Henry entrusted the work of rebuilding to his chamberlain, Radulfus, the son of King Stephen. Radulfus first built the church of St. Mary in the place where, from the beginning, the Vetusta had stood, with squared stones of the most perfect workmanship, profusely ornamented. The walls were supposed to have been built outside those of the earlier building, so as to enclose it, and the remains of the older building were not removed until the walls of the latter were completed. The Church of St. Mary, known as Mary's Chapel, or St. Joseph's Chapel, the most perfect of the ecclesiastical ruins of Glastonbury Abbey, was built in the late transitional or Norman style of architecture, and remains to this day an admirable specimen of medieval masonry. Ornamentation consists of wide expanses of fine ashlar masonry and running patterns of foliage and tendrils containing painted sun and stars. The flooring was composed of encaustic tiles, the colour being fused on with hot irons. Three of the walls are still standing, and in the north and south walls are four round-headed, richly moulded windows, mullioned and rising nearly to the vaulting. A beautiful triple window at the west end added light to the chapel. The overall dimensions of the chapel was 55 foot in length and 24.5 foot in width. The Lady Chapel was finished and dedicated on St. Barnabas's Day, June the 11th, 1186, by Reginald, Bishop of Bath. The chapel was originally a detached building, with a turret at each corner. At the present day, two of these turrets remain. When the larger building, St. Peter and St. Paul, was built east of the Lady Chapel, a flight of stairs extending across the building from wall to wall was constructed to provide access to the Galilee, or porch, which formed a junction between the two buildings. Two richly carved doorways occupy bays north and south, and the south door opened up to the monks' churchyard. Over the doorways are sculptures illustrating biblical scenes. Unfortunately, these sculptures that were decorating these beautiful Norman doorways are in a very dilapidated state, making it difficult to decipher them. Our best interpretations come from a paper read before the Somerset Archaeological Society at Wells in 1888 by Mr. Hope. He describes the four arches of the northern doors as number 1, the inner, and number 3 as resting each on the jamb shafts, while number 2 and number 4 are continuous bands springing from the ground around the arch and reaching the grounds again. The figures on these bands are, on band number 1, beginning from the left, a woman kneeling, the Annunciation, an angel, also from the Annunciation, two women embracing, the Salutation, a large group under the arches denoting a house with a bed in the centre with a sitting figure at the head, the Nativity, the sitting figure being Joseph, with a virgin and a child in the bed. The broken section probably contained the ox and ass on the right. Then there is a large group, difficult to make out. On the left is a figure sitting with his back to, but his face turned to, an angel with outstretched wings. On the right of the angel is a small barefooted figure, and beyond that, a larger figure. There are also some standing figures, all crowned, evidently the three kings, asking of Herod, "Where is he that is born, the King of Judah. Bands numbers 2 and 4 are filled with miscellaneous figures and things pertaining to agriculture and the life of the time and neighbourhood. Band number 3 consists of 18 loops, containing a king standing, much broken, probably a magi, a standing figure with his head gone, another magi, a man kneeling on one knee, the third magi, Our Lady and Child sitting, receiving gifts for the magi. Each of these loops contains a mounted figure riding away, and that is the three kings going home. Then there's another one which contains a bed with a man asleep with clouds above, with an angel issuing from the clouds. And this is the old way of depicting a vision, and represents the three kings being warned to return to their own country by another way. There's an armed figure holding a shield and a club or mace, a sitting king, a knight in chainmail striking at some object on his left or in his hand, a knight in chainmail with an infant impaled on his sword, and these last four loops depict the massacre of the innocents by Herod. Two women weeping, and that's from In Rama, was a voice heard, lamentations and weeping. A man in bed with the hand of God issuing from a cloud above, that's Joseph being warned of the death of Herod. An animal which is broken, but clearly the return from Egypt. A man carrying luggage, and that would be Joseph. And those last two are all part of one subject. Reginald, the Bishop of Bath, laid out the foundations of the new major ecclesia. Its dimensions were 400 feet in length and 80 feet in width. The chronicler, Adam de Domeran, who continued William of Malmesbury's History of Glastonbury to the year AD 1290, narrates that the stones of the great palace, built by Bishop Henry, also the entire wall which surrounded the monastery, were used in the foundation, and that a great part of the major ecclesia, the great church, having been built, the remainder would have been completed had the king's life been spared. Unfortunately, Henry II died in AD 1189, just 5 years after the foundations of the church had been laid. Henry's son and successor, Richard Coeur de Lion, Richard the Lionhearted, was too taken up by his great crusade to continue the building. Funds, once allocated for building the abbey, were diverted for other purposes. The monks tried to raise money by various means, but were not successful. But the rebuilding progressed slowly, and at times it stood still entirely. It was more than 100 years before the work of the great church was completed. And then, in AD 1275, years of work were destroyed by an earthquake that severely damaged the walls, necessitating replacement of many stones. The work of rebuilding the great church, according to ecclesiastical building custom of the period, commenced at the east end and continued westwards until its junction with St. Mary's Chapel, again also known as St. Joseph's Chapel. Its plan represented a cruciform church, bays forming the arms of a cross, and a square at the east end. The nave consisted of 10 bays. At first, the choir consisted of 4. But it was then increased to 6 by Abbot Monnington in AD 1371, and copied after the choir at Wells Cathedral, which in the first half of the 14th century had been lengthened from 3 to 6. The side aisle walls of the abbey extended 2 bays beyond the eastern gable, and continued at the back of it, thus forming the retro or processional aisle. Abbot Fromont, AD 1303, commenced the Great Hall of the Abbey, which was completed by Abbot Monnington, who partly rebuilt the chapter house. This was in turn completed by his successor, Abbot Chinnock. Abbot Adam de Sodbury, AD 1322-1325, quote, vaulted nearly all the nave and ornamented it with splendid paintings. He gave the great clock, now in Wells Cathedral, and also organs of wonderful magnitude. He endowed the Lady Chapel with 4 additional priests. He decorated the high altar with an image of the Virgin in the tabernacle of the highest workmanship. Close quote. It is believed that the Great Clock, given to the abbey by Adam de Sodbury, was made by a Glastonbury monk by the name of Peter Lightfoot. John Leland, writing in AD 1539, says of a clock which he saw at Glastonbury, "Peter Lightfoot, the monk, made this clock." The clock was placed in the south transept of the abbey. At the dissolution of the abbey in AD 1529, the clock, with its automatic mechanism, was carried to Wells and placed in the north transept of the cathedral. The works have been renewed several times, but it is the oldest known clock, self-striking the hours with a count wheel. The dial plate is 6.5 foot in diameter, contained in a square frame, having the figure of an angel holding a man's head puffing in each corner. The outer figure is divided into 24 parts, representing the 24 hours in a day. The numbers are in Old English characters and mark the hours from 12 at noon to midnight, and then to 12 at midday. A large gilt star points to the hour. An inner or second circle shows the minutes, and a small star moves around the circle every hour. A third circle gives the age of the moon. A plate in this circle shows the moon. There is also a smaller circle in which there is a female figure, having around it the motto, "Semper peregrat Phoebe." So progresses Phoebe. Above the dial plate is a panelled tower, around which four knights on horseback revolve in opposite directions every hour on the striking of the clock, and they represent a mimic tournament. The knights rush around with such ferocity that one unfortunate is felled at each encounter, and he has barely enough time to recover his upright position before he is again knocked down with a resounding clatter upon his horse's back. On passing behind the turret, the smitten knight is automatically set up again, only to receive another knockout blow, and so on, in rapid succession during several encounters with a most comic effect. The other three knights fight 24 times a day, unscathed. A figure in the costume of King Charles I, which may have replaced one of more ancient date, is seated some distance from the clock at a higher elevation. The figure strikes with its heels against bells, 2 strokes at the quarter hour, 4 strokes at the half hour, 6 strokes at the third quarter, and 8 strokes at the hour. It also strikes with a hammer on a bell the number of the hour. One inscription on the clock gives the key to the whole clock face. Around the moon plate are the words, "Sphericus archetypum globus hic monstrat microcosmum," which is translated as, "This circular or rounded dial represents the actual universe in miniature. This accounts for the sun, the stars, the moon, and the earth in the centre, as it was then visualised. The figures of the angels, each holding a man's head puffing, represent the 4 cardinal winds. To summarise the astronomical aspect of the clock, we have the earth at the centre, with the moon revolving around it in strict accordance with the Ptolemaic conceptions of the diurnal, or daily happenings, and proper motions. The sun making its journey around the earth once in 24 hours. The starry firmament outside these, and the 4 cardinal winds in their traditional places at the corners. Lightfoot's clock, then, is not merely a clock, but is essentially a model illustrating fundamental medieval conceptions of creation and the universe. It is remarkable that a simple monk of Glastonbury Abbey had the ingenuity and skill to devise and construct such a clock. Abbot Brainton, AD 1335 to 41, built the prior's hall, the refectory, the kitchen, the steps which led up to the orchard, and commenced building the abbot's chapel, which was then completed by Abbot Selwood, as he died in 1493. Abbot Chinnock, from AD 1374 to 1420, rebuilt the cloister, which had been allowed to fall into disrepair, the dormitory, and the fratery. He was interred in the chapter house which he had finished. Abbot Beer, AD 1493 to 1524, ruled the abbey for 31 years. He excavated the crypt of Mary's chapel and raised the floor to seat level. He also added the tracery to the windows. In addition, he built the Loreto Chapel, the Chapel of the Sepulchre, part of the Edgar Chapel, and built the lodgings by the Great Chamber, called the King's Lodging, for secular priests and clerks of Our Lady. The crypt in Mary's Chapel was excavated to provide burial space for the faithful within the walls of the chapel. The desire of those who could pay for the privilege of finding final resting place in the immemorial vicinity of where Joseph, and perhaps Mary herself, ever increased as time went on. Lead from the crowned coffins there, less than 100 years later, formed a part of the spoil of the destroyers. The excavation extended from the foot of the steps which lead into the great church, but not carried under them, the whole length of the chapel from east to west, the extreme thickness of the walls, 6 foot, and the depth of the foundations over 12 foot, allowed the crypt to be excavated to a depth of 11 feet. A perpendicular doorway at the northwest corner bled into the crypt, and in 1825 Mr. John Fry Reeves, the then owner of the abbey grounds, had the crypt cleared out. He found the steps ruined. In order to effect a better entrance, he cleared a passage some yards to the north, and in making the necessary excavations, 18 coffins were found, all placed east and west. The length of one was 8 foot 3 inches inside, and the whole length of it was filled with a skeleton. All the coffins were made of oak, 2 to 3 inches thick. Under the head and shoulders of each corpse was placed a bundle of wood shavings. Beneath and on the right side of each skeleton was a rod or thorn of the same length as the coffin. On the south side of the crypt is an arched recess. The following description of its discovery appears in Warner's Glastonbury. The Holy Well was discovered in 1825 in searching for hidden antiquities by a party of gentlemen. In the crypt, then choked up with rubbish, they sank a pit, and when their progress was arrested by a mass of stonework, this was found to be the crown of the arch. The labour of a few hours detected a flight of steps leading to this subterranean recess, uncovered a pavement at the depth of 10 or 12 feet from the surface, and displayed a small well, overhung and protected by the arch above it. An admeasurement of chamber and well, length of recess 17 foot, diameter of the wall 2 foot 2 inches, depth 4 foot 9 inches, with an ornamental scroll decorating the arch of the recess. The well is outside the foundation wall of the chapel, and is as old at least as the chapel itself. The round-headed arch of the recess is ornamented with a zigzag scroll of the same character as that which so beautifully decorates the ruins of the chapel. Opposite the well, there is a singular stair of 5 steps, and these lead by a passage to a flight of steps in the thickness of the wall to a low doorway through an arcade. The doorway must have led to a small chapel, which stood on the south side of the Lady Chapel. Traces of its abutment upon the outside wall of the chapel are plainly visible. In AD 1524, the last abbot, Richard Whiting, was appointed. He had the unfortunate fate to be caught up in the tumult of the dissolution of the monasteries under King Henry VIII. In the 26th year of King Henry's reign, AD 1535, when the king had been declared supreme head of the church, Abbot Whiting, at the head of his monks, signed the deed and thus showed his obedience to the king. Afterwards, when called upon to surrender his monastery, he peremptorily refused to do so, as it being against his conscience. In September AD 1539, 3 commissioners were sent by the king to inspect the abbey. In the library, they found a book opposed to Henry's divorce, and the oath of supremacy was then offered to the abbot. Whiting refused to take the oath, and was taken to the Tower of London for further questioning by Cardinal Wolsey. While Abbot Whiting was incarcerated, another examination of the monastery was made. This time, a gold chalice and other plates were found hidden by the abbot that had not been shown to the commissioners. This was considered the very highest and rank of all treasons, and the abbot remained imprisoned until November the 14th, when he was taken back to Wells, Somerset, for trial. Whiting was convicted with two other monks, and they were sentenced to be hanged. The order, attributed to Thomas Cromwell, read, "Item, the abbot of Glaston, to be tried at Glaston, and also to be executed there." That is, retried. The next day, they were all drawn on hurdles to the Tor, hanged, disemboweled, beheaded, and quartered. The poor old abbot's white head was set up over the gate, and his quarters, boiled in pitch, were displayed at Wells, Bath, Ilchester, and Bridgewater. At Abbot Whiting's death, AD 1539, the abbey came into the king's possession. The lands were divided and sold, the monks and the servants dismissed, the holy relics and treasures sent in bags to the king. The buildings were then broken up and sold in pieces. The destruction of Roche Abbey, described by eyewitnesses of the fate, may tell us of the fate of the Glastonbury Abbey. Quote, "Some took the service books that lied in the church, and laid them upon their wain coppice to piece the same. Some took windows of the haylath, and hid them in their hay. And likewise they did of many other things, for some pulled forth iron hooks out of the walls that brought none, when the yeomen and gentlemen of the country had bought the timber of the church. For the church was the first thing that was put to the spoil, and then the abbot's lodging, daughter, and freighter, with the cloister, and all the buildings thereabouts, for nothing was spared, but the ox-houses, and swine-cots, and such other houses of office that stood without the walls, which had more favour showed them than the very church itself, which was done by the advice of Cromwell, as Fox reporteth in his Book of Acts and Monuments." While the ruthless destruction of the abbeys is appalling, and the sacredness of human life ignored, one should not lose all sense of proportion and sound judgment concerning the necessity of the Reformation. Britain had to have a man like Henry VIII, because she had a king like Inna, who surrendered the abbeys to a Roman pope. It is impossible for us to know through what persons or in what manner God will act at any time, although it is obvious that it is he who is acting. Henry VIII was only a pawn in the hand of the Lord, used to break down the old Roman ecclesiastical order in Britain. Also, the arrogancy of some of the abbots towards the people played no small part in the suppression of the monasteries. Reverend L. S. Lewis, who wrote so learnedly and so well on Glastonbury, says, "We must come to the conclusion, while gratefully acknowledging the work of the monks here and elsewhere, so needed in their age, that had this great abbey remained true to God and herself, had there been less quarrelling, less greed, less haughtiness, and more simple religion, he would have guarded it to this day." That's from Glastonbury, Her Saints. And he also adds, "The abbeys were to reap the whirlwind of their faults." It should be added that by contrast to other abbeys of the period, Glastonbury was well managed and loved by the people under its jurisdiction. To fully understand the monastic system, one must be brought face to face with the spectacle of the abbeys in the 14th and 15th centuries. They were rich in worldly possessions, as glorious as they were in architectural splendour. The Benedictine monks had forsworn the world, only to repossess its luxuries under a more assured condition. When Henry VIII came, they had become so drugged with the rich, poisonous wines of enjoyment that not only the monks, but many abbots themselves had turned into thieves and common pilferers. Many of the abbey treasures were deliberately stolen, hidden away, or sold by the prior ascetics, who had voluntarily taken the vows of poverty and sanctity. A 19th century antiquarian, standing in the ruins of the Glastonbury Abbey, reflecting on its past glories, wrote, "History pictures these shadowy aisles filled with the pomp and splendour of those bygone ceremonies, with the long procession of the monks, with the kingly abbot, who, as he swept in state from his monastery along the cloistered walk, could rest his eyes on a fair and smiling country, which, as far as he could see, was all his own. As the choir boys' quarrels smote his ear, heaven and earth must indeed have seemed to clap their hands for joy over so royal a possession. Perhaps if the sons of heaven had less interest in fat living and not attempted to appropriate so much of earth, the swift-footed nemesis of the Reformation might have stayed its speed. It is a pity that these brethren could not have gone out in a greater blaze of glory. That's from Cathedral Days by A.B. Dodd. For over 200 years, the abbey served as a quarry for desecrating builders. Half of Glastonbury town, as well as the long causeway across the Sedgemoor, has been constructed out of its fallen mass of ruins. Stones were taken for the erection of walls, sheds, and farm buildings. Thus, the abbey stone is scattered over a radius of many miles from the town. The excellent squared freestone proved a most tempting spoil for the house builders, who also found use for the rubbled core of the walls and the heavy stonework of the foundations. The Canon manuscript gives the lamentable record of one Vandal tenant of the abbey as one Thomas Prue, a rank Presbyterian, who pulled down and sold vast quantities of ye stones and rooted up ye vaults by blowing them up with gunpowder. He also pulled down ye ancient hall, and with the stones built a dwelling house near ye gate called Magdalene's Gate, and placed in ye front and walls ye arms, ciphers, and other decorations and figures of ye abbots and priors and escutcheons, which was once in ye old buildings. And many other stones he sold to amend ye roads and highways, and to ye townspeople, with which many houses have been built, and it was observable yet such houses so built did not long stand, nor the possessors thrive. A final period of destruction was inaugurated by one John Down, also a Presbyterian, who held the abbey for 60 years during the latter part of the 18th and the first few decades of the 19th centuries. It was during his tenancy that the last trace of two small chapels, Loretto and Edgar chapels, including their foundations, disappeared. After the death of John Down, the abbey passed into the hands of more reverent custodians. Since then, its history has been a more fortunate one. One owner, a Mr. Reeves, did much to preserve what was left. It was he who threw across the area of the crypt of St. Mary's Chapel the arches of plain stone. These arches have helped greatly to prevent the further subsidence of this structure after the fall of the vault, which happened in AD 1784, when practically the whole of the floor disappeared into the crypt below, and the vault filled with water. One of the most unique monuments that remains from these times is an ancient stone that silently stares down on the beholder from the standing outside the south wall of the Lady or Mary's Chapel. This time and weather-worn tablet has puzzled scholars for centuries. It bears but two names, Jesus and Maria, and the lettering is Lombardic 13th century. Devoid of any other markings with a definite meaning, it has all the hallmarks of a very ancient piece of masonry, preserved from the disastrous fire of AD 1184. The question is often asked by visitors, why was it put there, and what does it mean? Reverend Lewis gives a plausible answer. It represents the signature of Jesus, naming the dowry he had provided for his mother Mary. He goes on to explain that the title, Domus Dei, or House of God, which was attached to the chapel, represents the Wattle Church or Temple, because therein he dwelt. And Secretum Domini, or Secret of the Lord, which is also attached to the chapel was the dowry and dedication of the same to his mother. In substance, the ancient stone registers the record and site of Our Lady's dowry. This same title is officially recorded in the historical Domesday Book and does substantiate this interpretation. The Glastonbury Abbey estate of some 40 acres was purchased in 1907 on behalf of the Church of England by public subscription at a cost of £36,000. The property is vested in the Bath and Wells Diocesan Trustees upon trusts declared in a trust document dated 6th of June 1908. The estate comprises the ruins of the ancient abbey, the Abbey House, now a diocesan house of retreat, conference and study, and the park lands, the abbey gatehouses and three cottages. On June the 22nd, 1908, a Thanksgiving service was held in the Glastonbury Abbey ruins. It was attended on behalf of the Crown by the Prince and Princess of Wales, later to become King George V and Queen Mary, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Davidson, and a large number of prelates and clergy took part. Since that day, an annual pilgrimage takes place there on the last Saturday in June. The ecclesiastical leaders of the English Church rededicate themselves to Christ at Glastonbury. Today, having endured the weather, the storms, and the violence of many generations, Glastonbury Abbey still stands. Pilgrims from all corners of the world have visited and continue to visit this holy shrine. There can be no doubt that the Glastonbury Abbey is the oldest continuous Christian foundation in the world. Since the time when Joseph built his first church on the sacred Isle of Avalon, men have worshipped Christ on that site. The buildings may have changed, the ecclesiastical orders may have changed, but worship of the Lamb of God has never ceased at Glastonbury Abbey.
You're listening to Radio Arian at Radio Arian.